The headlines: Israel carries airstrikes on the Gaza Strip for the fifth straight day, prompting Palestinian resistance groups to retaliate with rockets. Also in Palestine, Israeli troops raid a refugee camp in the West Bank, killing two Palestinians and injuring several others. And Turkey's bracing for presidential and parliamentary elections set to take place on Sunday. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: the Israeli regime continues its airstrikes on the besieged Gaza Strip for the fifth straight day. Israeli warplanes have struck different parts of Gaza, but there's no immediate reports of casualties and damage from Saturday's attacks. In retaliation, however, Palestinian resistance groups fired more rockets toward Israeli settlements across the Gaza fence, as well as the Israeli city of Ashkelon. Palestinians have fired nearly 1,100 missiles and rockets into Israel since Tuesday. At least 33 Palestinians have also been killed and nearly 150 wounded in the regime's attacks. Several resistance commanders are among those killed. Palestinians say their retaliatory attacks will continue until Tel Aviv stops its policy of assassinating resistance leaders. Asher Shannon is joining us now from Gaza with all the latest updates the Israeli regime continues to carry out airstrikes against the besieged Palestinian enclave of Gaza. Ashraf, what updates and details do you have to share with us right now?
Well, Maria, so far the Israeli regime forces have bombed four homes in the Gaza Strip. The first bombings took place the early hours of the morning, targeting a house in Gaza City, totally destroying it. And another house in the east of Gaza, Shijaiya neighborhood, was partially destroyed. And just over the last 20 to 25 minutes, they bombed two more homes, one in the northern Gaza Strip town of Bethlehem, and the latest one in the northern Gaza Strip town of Beth Hanun. In addition to bombing farmlands throughout the Gaza Strip since the early hours of the day. This while the Palestinian resistance factions, mainly the Islamic Jihad's military wing, the Al-Quds Brigades, fired volleys of rockets towards Israeli towns east and north of the Gaza Strip. According to the Israeli regime, at least 1,100 rockets were fired since the beginning of this Israeli onslaught against Gaza. I'm talking about 1,100 rockets fired from Gaza. And Israel's so-called missile interception system managed to down nearly only 30% of those rockets, showing the failure of this multi-billion-dollar system. And also the Israeli regime was forced to use the David Sling missile interception system to down one of the rockets that hit an area near Tel Aviv, while another rocket managed to hit a building, killing an Israeli. So far, the Israeli regime has killed 33 Palestinians and injured around 160. Among the fatalities, six children, three women, and four elderly people. And also among the wounded are many children and women. But yeah.
All right, stay with us, Ashraf. I believe we have the latest footage coming in right now from a funeral procession that was taking place in Gaza for a number of the Islamic Jihad commanders that were assassinated by the Israeli regime. We're waiting to see those images. In relation to what was just said about the assassination attempts, Hamas and Islamic Jihad have both stated that that will not deter the Palestinian resistance from defending the motherland. Those are the exact words. And also, last night, leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, also stated that this assassination plot and assassination attempts by the Israelis has failed to sow discord between the Palestinian factions. And also, apart from that, If this continues, it will lead to an all-out conflict. Help us better understand what was said.
Well, what's happening is that Palestinian factions are coordinating together within the joint chamber of resistance in the Gaza Strip that has representatives from all Palestinian resistance groups, and they've been managing this retaliatory attacks against the Israeli regime since day one of this onslaught. Unity is what Palestinians in Gaza are talking about. They know that unity will continue to strengthen among Palestinian factions in the face of the ongoing Israeli regime, although the Israeli regime, since day one, kept saying, we are assassinating Islamic Jihad commanders, we are targeting Islamic Jihad sites, trying to sow division between Palestinian factions. But what's happening is quite the opposite.
All right, thanks a lot, Ashraf. One last question before we leave you, though, Ashraf. How do Palestinians feel about the international silence and inaction? Before we get to that, those are the images that we mentioned, Justin, from earlier today, where the funeral procession is taking place. If I'm correct, six Islamic Jihad commanders have been assassinated by the Israeli regime over the past few days, and Islamic Jihad and Hamas and Palestinian resistance groups have stated that these actions will have consequences. The blood of the martyrs will not go in vain, and the Israeli regime must anticipate a strong response from the Palestinian resistance. However, we've already seen a response coming in from Gaza as a barrage of rockets has been landing in occupied territories in Israel, exposing with that the weakness of the much-touted missile defense system of the Israelis. So for those of you just joining us, we're seeing a funeral procession that's taking place for the Islamic Jihad commanders that were assassinated by the Palestinian, by the Israeli regime yesterday. In total, if I'm correct, six Palestinian Islamic Jihad leaders have been killed by the Israeli regime's assassination and onslaught against the Gaza Strip. Ashraf, how do Palestinians feel about the international silence and the international inaction as the Israeli attacks continue, and among those killed are women and children?
Well, first of all, let's talk about the funeral. This funeral is the funeral of the late commander of Islamic Jihad's military wing, the Al-Quds Brigades, Iyad Al-Hassani. He was killed yesterday along with his friends, inside an apartment in the Al-Nasr neighborhood in north of in the northern area of Gaza City. It's an apartment building, seven-story building. And they were assassinating inside that apartment, and also around 10 people were injured, including women and children. Regarding the silence of the international community, Palestinians are not surprised by this because they've seen this since 1948. For more than 75 years, Palestinians have learned and realized that the international community keep supporting the Israeli regime and ignoring the suffering and pains of Palestinians, and they've been attempting to draw the attention of the international community. We're not even talking about armed resistance. Let's go back to March 2018, when Palestinians launched the Great March of Return, a peaceful march in the east of the enclave, and on a daily basis, Israeli forces were killing unarmed young women, men and children, elderly people who were protesting peacefully under the watchful eye of the international community, who failed to protect Palestinians. So no matter what Palestinians do, whether it's peaceful resistance or armed resistance. The international community refuses to stand by the Palestinians, although armed resistance is a right protected under international law for people under occupation.
All right, thanks a lot, Ashraf Shannon, joining us from Gaza. The Israeli military has once again raided a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. The raid has left two Palestinians dead and several others injured. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, earlier joined us to give details about the Israeli raid.
It seems that Israeli undercover units, this means that Israeli forces described as Palestinians entered the refugee camp of Balata, the neighborhood of Al Jasamin in Balata refugee camp. Then Israeli forces raided the refugee camp and surrounded a building there. They were demanding via loudspeakers Palestinians inside this building to turn themselves, or that the Israeli forces would explode the house. Then clashes had been taking place between the residents and fighters inside the refugee camp of Balata with Israeli forces. In the last few days, Palestinian resistance groups, including the Jihad movement, Lion's Den, and Jenin Brigade, issued statements saying that what's going on in Gaza and the airstrikes that are taking place against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and the increased number of martyrs, this means that Palestinians will continue their struggle here in the occupied West Bank.
The leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says Israelis failed to drive a wedge between Palestinian resistance groups through its latest aggression against the Gaza Strip. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah says resistance groups have remained united and foiled enemy plots. He added that Israel's attacks on Gaza are also a futile attempt to cover up the regime's internal crisis and restore its deterrent power. Nasrallah further said the Lebanese resistance movement will not hesitate to support Palestinians in the face of Israel's deadly violence.
We are in constant contact with the leaders of the Palestinian factions, and we are monitoring their situation and all developments minute by minute. We are providing all possible help within certain limits. But I'd like to add that at any time, if the responsibility falls on us to make a move or more, we will not hesitate to do so, God willing.
The Hezbollah leader also denounced the international community's silence on Israeli crimes against Palestinians. Elsewhere, he touched upon the normalization of ties between Syria and Arab countries. Nasrallah said the rapprochement has brought positive results for the region and called on Lebanon to restore ties with Syria as soon as possible. Our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, explains in more detail the Hezbollah leader's stance on supporting Palestinian resistance groups.
Of course, when it comes to the stance of Hezbollah as a resistance, he said that they are in contact minute by minute with the Palestinian resistance, and they are following up, of course, on a minute by minute everything that's happening, and are giving limited assistance. However, he did mention, which is something very significant and would of course reverberate with the Israelis, which is that Hezbollah, whenever they feel necessary to take any measure or any steps in assistance or to give assistance to the resistance, then they will not hesitate. So that is something that I think we will see a lot of analysis from the Israeli side on what the type of assistance that Hezbollah might give, other than the fact that they have extending arms, they are giving logistic support, they are giving financial support, they are giving political and moral support. What type of assistance could Hezbollah, what more can Hezbollah do in order to give assistance to the Palestinian resistance?
Iran's foreign minister says the Islamic Republic has made arrangements for the official opening of its diplomatic mission and consulate in Saudi Arabia. Hossein Amir Abdollahian was speaking on the phone with his Saudi counterpart, Prince Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud. He said the recent visits by officials from the two countries show that both Tehran and Riyadh are determined to cooperate with each other. Prince Faisal, for his part, expressed hope that the cooperation between the two sides will be facilitated by sending their respective ambassadors to Tehran and Riyadh. Iran and Saudi Arabia agreed to restore ties in talks held in the Chinese capital in March. The China broker deal put an end to 7 years of strained ties. People in Turkey are set to cast their ballots in presidential and parliamentary elections on Sunday. The elections are a litmus test for President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his ruling Justice and Development, or the AK Party. 64 million people are eligible to elect 600 member of parliament and the next head of the state, around 2 million. Turks living abroad already cast their votes on April the 17th. Incumbent Erdogan is among four candidates approved by the country's electoral body. According to opinion polls, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, leader of the main opposition, is another frontrunner in the presidential race. Candidates held their final campaign rally on Friday to woo many of the 5 million first-time voters. A runoff is expected 2 weeks later if none of the presidential candidates crosses the 50% threshold necessary to win the race. Author and activist Fra Hughes tells us how the significance of Turkey's elections goes beyond its borders.
It's not just the most important election in Turkey's recent history. It is actually the most important election across the whole region. If we look back to the 15th of July, 2016, America under Obama and Biden tried a failed coup against Erdogan. They tried to install Gulen, who was a resident in the United States of America. Erdogan called out the people onto the streets to fight the coup, and that's what the people did. So even in 2016, we were seeing that the American administration was trying to get rid of Erdogan, and what they did was actually push him closer to Russia, closer to China, and with the rapport between Saudi Arabia and Iran, he has moved closer to Syria and those other two countries. So what's at stake here is actually the whole future of the Middle East, not just the future of Turkey, its government and its election. Erdogan is moving closer to a wider Arab-Persian collective. He is moving closer to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. He is moving closer to Eurasia and BRICS. This is the future not only for the region, but it is the future for Turkey. Now, the Americans want to get rid of Erdogan, and what they've done is they have consolidated and coalesced all the opposition around Erdogan's main competitor in this presidential election. These people, if elected, that new president will be pro-NATO. I would expect him to start giving armaments to the Ukraine. I would expect him to start causing more destabilization in Syria and to actually distance Turkey from this new Eurasian center and economic political powerhouse that's coming into being.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The U.S. banking sector has recently been hit by a major crisis, and experts believe this crisis is deepening. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Telegraph, almost half of the 4,800 banks in the U.S. are nearly insolvent, as they have burned through their capital buffers, the Telegraph reported recently, citing a group of banking experts. According to Professor Amit Saru, a banking expert at Stanford University, around half of U.S. lenders are underwater. He said, "Let's not pretend that this is just about Silicon Valley Bank and First Republic. A lot of U.S. banking system is potentially insolvent." Last week, First Republic was seized by U.S. financial regulators and acquired by J.P. Morgan, the country's biggest bank. The San Francisco-based lender had previously received a $30 billion rescue shot from a group of Wall Street banks in the form of deposits. The sale of First Republic Bank followed massive deposit runs in March, which caused two regional lenders, Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, to fail within days. Recently, shares of Los Angeles-based PacWest and Arizona's Western Alliance were suspended after their prices fell dramatically. Earlier this week, shares of several regional U.S. lenders plunged by at least 15%, triggering investor concerns about the financial health of other mid-sized banks. Around 2,315 banks across the U.S. are currently sitting on assets worth less than their liabilities, according to a Hoover Institution report by Professor Saru and a group of banking experts, as cited by the media. The market value of the loan portfolios of these lenders is reportedly $2 trillion lower than the stated book value. Professor Saru raised questions over the steps taken by U.S. financial watchdogs to tackle the problems faced by crisis-hit mid-sized lenders. The regulators can contain the immediate liquidity crisis by guaranteeing all deposits temporarily, according to Saru, who said, however, that this would not address the greater solvency crisis. Earlier, Forbes had noted, "Bank failures happen more often than you might think. There have been 566 in the United States since experts entered the new millennium. That's an average of almost 25 per year." But the back-to-back collapses of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, followed by the failure of First Republic Bank just 7 weeks later, are unique in more than ways than one in the United States history. While bank failures are relatively common, they have become a rarity in recent years. In the wake of the Great Recession, it was typical to see dozens, if not hundreds, of bank failures each year. This slowed significantly from 2015 to 2020, when the U.S. saw an average of fewer than five bank failures per year. Zero banks failed in both 2021 and 2022. Bank collapses were similarly uncommon in early 2000s. From 2001 to 2007, the United States saw an average of just 3.57 bank failures per year. The failure of Silicon Valley Bank on March 10, 2023, ended a run of 868 days with no bank failures, the second longest in the U.S. since 1933. The longest, that would be June 2004 through February 2007, nearly 3 years without a single bank failure leading up to the Great Recession. Forbes added, amid fears of a looming recession, Americans may be worried that 2023's back-to-back bank failures signaled the start of another downturn. The 2008 collapse of Washington Mutual is the largest bank failure in the U.S. history. Washington Mutual held $307 billion in assets when it failed. Like many other banks of the time, it fell under the weight of risky mortgage loans. First Republic Bank, which failed on May 1, 2023, is the second largest bank failure. It held approximately $229 billion in assets right before it went under. Based in San Francisco, First Republic is the third major bank to fail this year. Silicon Valley Bank was the third largest bank failure in the U.S. history, with $209 billion in assets at the end of 2022. SVB was one of the most well-known lenders for tech companies and startups, and 16th largest bank in the U.S. Just 2 days after SVB failure, regulators shut down Signature Bank, the fourth largest bank to fail in the U.S. Customers of Signature Bank, another startup and tech industry favorite, panicked after the failure of SVB and withdrew their deposits en masse. Signature Bank held $110 billion in assets at the end of last year. Failures in the United States may be common, but it's exceedingly rare to see a bank the size of SVB or Signature Bank collapse. If you look at FDIC's list of failed banks, you'd be forgiven for not recognizing any names from the last decade. It's usually smaller regional banks that shut down. The last bank to fail before SVB was Kansas-based Almena State Bank in 2020, a state-chartered bank with just $69 million in assets. The other three banks that failed in 2020, First City Bank of Florida, the First State Bank, and Erickson State Bank, held $136, $156, and $101 million in assets, respectively, near the time of failure. Silicon Valley Bank was roughly 2,000 times the size of these banks when it failed. Even in 2010, when 157 banks failed, the assets held by all these banks combined still totaled less than half of the assets held by Silicon Valley Bank alone.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Israel keeps pounding the Gaza Strip for a fourth straight day, and the death toll from Israel's strikes on the besieged Palestinian territory continues to rise. According to the health ministry, so far more than 30 Palestinians, including women and children, have lost their lives, and scores of others have been injured. Palestinian resistance groups have responded to the aggression by firing rockets into Israeli-occupied territories. The latest round of escalation was triggered by Israeli forces' assassination of four Islamic Jihad leaders on Tuesday. How far should the Israeli violence go for the international community to intervene and put an end to the crimes being committed against the Palestinian people? Joining us on Spotlight, we have Firas Elnajem, manager of Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, joining us from Toronto. And also international coordinator at the Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, Charlotte Cates, is joining us from Vancouver.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the program. To the both of you, let's start off with Mr. Elnajem in Toronto. How do you view the recent wave of Israeli violence and aggression against the Gaza Strip?
Yes. First, I would like to send condolences to the families of the martyrs and salute to the resistance in Palestine. This is a way for the Zionist regime and the Netanyahu administration to deflect from the real problems that they're having internally. And to divert the problem somewhere else. So he's really caught up in a lot of internal issues and problems within his own regime and his own people, his people, the settlers over there, and so on. And this is a way, kind of, just to run away from the problems. And he's also at the same time, they are testing the Palestinian resistance and the unity of the Palestinian resistance, because they've mostly targeted the Islamic Jihad movement. They really haven't targeted the Hamas movement. So maybe they're trying to also cause a division between the Islamic Jihad and Hamas, because when they target the Islamic Jihad leadership, Hamas obviously should take it as if they're targeting their own leadership, because they are all united against the Zionist regime. So this is also another thing, is to test the unity of the resistance and the strength of the resistance inside Palestine. At the same time, they're also testing the international community and to see what their responses are, because they're probably preparing for more atrocities and more intense battles with the Palestinian factions. They're very upset that Gaza is a liberated, blockaded area. I mean, we got to be honest with ourselves. Palestine overall is occupied, except Gaza. Gaza is a liberated land that's just blockaded, pretty much. You know what I mean? So it's occupied from outside, not from inside. The Zionists can't just enter inside Gaza. So this is a very big model, I think, that could be also implemented in different areas in Palestine. Hopefully, it could be transferred to the West Bank, to Haifa, different areas where the people will unite and push the Zionists and the IDF out of their areas and kind of build their own infrastructures and then kind of rely on, the axis of resistance. And that is obviously the Islamic Republic of Iran and the other factions that are allied with them, because that is the main infrastructure and main establishment that is supporting all these resistant movements.
Right.
So I think the Zionist regime is in a very, very weak spot right now. And we can see the missiles flying over from Gaza into Tel Aviv, into different cities. It's showing how weak the Zionist regime and how weak the settlers are as well.
Charlotte Cates, what are the goals and objectives for the Israeli regime right now? The Israelis are obviously known for seeking instability across the region and with countries surrounding it.
I think there are several objectives that they're trying to pursue. Like your other guest said, one of those objectives is to externalize the ongoing crisis and contradictions within the Zionist regime by creating a unified front around the bombing and killing of Palestinians and the occupation of further Palestinian land. And this has always been the point of unity of the Zionist forces, whether they call themselves liberal or they are openly fascist, like Ben-Gvir, Netanyahu, and his cohort, has always been the targeting of Palestinians. Another objective, quite clearly, is pursuing this ongoing policy of assassination. Now, of course, the policy of assassination is nothing new. This is something that the Zionist movement has and the Israeli state have continuously pursued. We've seen it in the 1970s, in the 1980s, in the early 2000s. We've seen it time and time again, and we're seeing it now, where there's an attempt to target some of the most effective leaders of the Palestinian resistance in an attempt to wipe out the length of experience that they have accumulated. However, at the same time, I think it's also clear that the resistance has established a balance of power and a framework of deterrence to actually stop these kinds of Zionist attacks. And what they're trying to do is reset the framework to an era before Gaza had developed this strong resistance, and they will not be able to do so. And that's very obvious in the response that we have seen continuously from the Palestinian people and the resistance, despite these horrific attacks.
Firas Sanajem, staying on this issue of the assassination of leaders of the resistance of the Palestinian factions, Hezbollah leader Seyed Hassan Nasrallah earlier today said that the Israeli killing of resistance leaders, and add to that women and children, will lead to an all-out conflict. Iran's foreign minister believes that this shows Israel's desperation and vulnerability in the face of Palestinian resistance. Elaborate on those comments for us, please.
Yes. I mean, they are trying to target the strength of the resistance, and obviously that is the leadership, right? And they know that the resistance now and the leadership is very unified, and this is all throughout Palestine. I mean, if we look at the history and track of what happened was after Sheikh Adnan Qadr Adnan, when he died, and he's part of the Islamic Jihad, when he died while he was in incarceration and he did a hunger strike and he died, and then the retaliation came from Gaza. I mean, so it shows that the resistance in all of different areas in Palestine is unified and they feel for each other. And this is a very beautiful development, actually, for the resistance, that anywhere you attack a Palestinian faction, the other groups in different cities will make sure that they avenge and they teach a lesson to the Zionist regime. And this is how it is now. The unification is what's really hurting the Zionists. And they're actually the opposite. They're disunited now, and you can see the streets of the illegitimate state of Israel is that it's full of people protesting. Well, now because of this recent escalation with the Gaza, it kind of maybe pushed the people away from protesting. And this is probably exactly what the Zionist regime wanted. They wanted people to focus on a war with the Palestinians and to have their rage and anger and hatred towards the Palestinians. And he's just deflecting, and this is only temporary. It's going to come back at him, Netanyahu, and it's going to burn his hands. I think he's going to be burned very bad for what he's doing by his own people, I think. I don't even think it has to be done by the Palestinians because there's a lot of dissatisfaction and there's a lot [S2] Sure. [S1] Of disunity and there's a lot of problems internally in the Zionist regime, this rotten regime.
Charlotte Cates, our guest in Toronto earlier, mentioned the issue of the unity of the different Palestinian factions. We can see now that all Palestinian resistance factions are uniting in the face of Israel's aggression. Are the Israelis worried about a united Palestinian resistance front, all groups and all parties uniting against the occupation?
It's very clear that particularly since the Battle of Saif al-Quds or the Unity Intifada 2 years ago in May 2021, this concern about the unity not only between the organizations of the resistance, but also between the Palestinian people throughout all the areas of Palestine, from the river to the sea, and with Palestinians in exile and diaspora, and with regional forces, Arab forces, and international forces for the liberation of Palestine, has been a major concern for the occupation forces. We saw this once again last year in August 2022 in the Battle of the Unity of the Fronts, and that this has become an increasingly heard slogan in the resistance movement in the past year that has come. So obviously, this is something that is a strong weapon for the Palestinian people. What's happened in the past 30 years is that the unity of the Palestinian people has been disrupted and undermined by the so-called peace process, by attempting to liquidate the Palestinian cause, by tearing off segments of the Palestinian people, or creating a so-called Palestinian Authority in the West Bank to serve as a security force for the occupation and not for defense for the Palestinian people. And what the resistance has done, on the contrary, is actually to restore a real national unity and unified framework to confront occupation and fight for liberation. And so this is something that the occupation wants to target. This is why they make these statements about, oh, we're only targeting Islamic Jihad, or we're only targeting this force or this faction. The purpose of this is to attempt to break apart the unity of the resistance that exists, and yet that we continue to see from the Joint Operations Room of the resistance, making it clear that that unity has not been disrupted or divided. But we can see that this has always been a goal of the Zionist project, is to disrupt and dismantle Palestinian unity. And it's clear that these leaders that are targeted for assassination are not only leaders of one party or force or faction, although they are distinguished in that role, they are leaders of the Palestinian resistance, and they are leaders of a resistance movement that is really providing a different vision for humanity around the world, that it's possible to resist imperialism, colonialism, and Zionism despite the balance of technological power that the occupation continues to hold because of its, you know, billions of dollars in U.S. weaponry that it receives every year.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Right. Firas and Najim, let's go back to the issue of the Palestinian resistance response to the latest Israeli aggression. The intensified Palestinian rocket attacks in response to the Israeli aggression at the Israeli targets have, by many accounts, exposed weaknesses of the regime's much-touted anti-missile systems. Will the growing Palestinian military capabilities pose a major challenge for Tel Aviv now? Should, in other words, should the Israelis start to feel less secure now?
Yes, I mean, it's very obvious. Like, we've seen the rockets, a good portion of them landed in Tel Aviv and Sidrot and all these different cities. And the sirens were very loud everywhere, and people were hiding in different areas, and they see missiles hit different areas. The resistance is getting more experience, more strength, and they're advancing with their weaponry as well, because they have assistance from the Islamic Republic of Iran and from, the Hezbollah and from, the Popular Mobilization Forces in Iraq. I mean, all the ones that fought, against the colonial powers, against terrorist groups such as ISIS and so on. They've learned a lot of experience, and they're also assisting each other and supporting each other in different ways, logistically, information-wise, technology, different ways, right? And the Palestinian factions are getting stronger and stronger, right? And we, it's not just them. I mean, even the young children, the sons and daughters of these leaders that were assassinated, you can see the way they spoke was so bold, with so much belief and bravery, and they have so much certainty that they will be the generation of liberation. I mean, this is a slogan that we're going to be using because we have an annual walk against Israel, as the Zionists here celebrate 75 years of occupation every year. They celebrate and they walk with Israel, so they go in thousands and they do a marathon, unfortunately, in the name of Israel, the state of Israel. You know, and our slogan is, we are the generation of liberation. And tomorrow and this weekend will be marking the Nakba, the catastrophic event of stealing Palestine and occupying Palestine. And I think all over Canada, all over the States, all over the West, there's massive amounts of rallies that are happening, and it's growing more and more everywhere in the world. And people are paying more attention to the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian suffering. And we're going to continue to raise the flag of Palestine and call for a free Palestine and for the liberation of the Holy Land of Palestine. And the thing about it is the Jewish people also come. Like rabbis from New York are coming to our protest. Rabbis from Montreal are coming to our protest. And they're against Israel. They're against the Zionist regime. Just like Muslims are against ISIS and against Daesh. I mean, it's the same thing. You know, it's a kidnapping. It's a hijacking of a holy name, holy religion. And used for an evil project, a colonial project, a settler project, a terrorist organization, a terrorist regime such as Israel. And it's very near. We can see that it's getting weaker and weaker, and hopefully that we will see liberation in our generation.
Charlotte Cates, Said Hassan Nasrallah of Hezbollah said that despite continuation of aggression against Gaza, the battle of resistance has not stopped. Many analysts also say that resistance is the most viable option left for Palestinians. Do you see it in that light as well? How important is this consistent resistance?
Palestinian resistance has continued since the beginning of colonialism and occupation in Palestine, and it's continuing today. And it's clear that just as, you know, as was stated, you know, 50 years ago, that resistance is the strategic choice and the path forward for the Palestinian movement, because with it's the resistance that's defending the people and the land of Palestine from the river to the sea and providing a real mechanism of meaningful pressure and accountability on the occupation, which is not being done by any international force or body. Instead, the Western powers are lining up. Now they suddenly are concerned about achieving a ceasefire in Gaza because they are seeing a response from the resistance. And so it's clear that the resistance is a strategic choice and a path forward for the Palestinian people. This is as the guest from Toronto said, this is also marking the 75th commemoration of al-Nakba. There are going to be people around the world marching in the streets this weekend and in the coming days, not just to commemorate 75 years of genocide and 75 years of attacks and 75 years of dispossession, but also to celebrate 75 years of resistance for liberation and return. And right now it is the resistance on the front lines throughout occupied Palestine, in Gaza, in the West Bank, fighting back, fighting against the occupier, and showing that it is possible to strike a real blow against these forces despite their backing by the most powerful imperialist forces in the world. That when we go out and march for Palestine this weekend, we are marching in solidarity with the Palestinian people and their resistance for liberation and return.
For us, Najim, one of the most alarming aspects of all of this is the Israeli impunity. Hamas said the silence of the international community emboldens Israel to continue its aggression. Earlier today, Hezbollah's Hassan Nasrallah said the world turning a blind eye to the Israeli killing of women and children is alarming. How do the Israelis get away with these crimes, and how can this status quo change?
They get away with it because of the Zionist lobbies and, you know, their rich Zionists that support certain politicians and, you know, a way to bully them and blackmail them and bribe them and things like this. This is what they've been doing for many, many years, manipulating things, controlling media slowly, controlling a lot of different important dimensions of the system in Canada and the States, everywhere. And the United Nations is silent. You know, they're crying about Ukraine, a one-year-old conflict, but then 75 years of occupation. You know, there's no equality. You know, and there's selectivity based on human rights of who they care about, who is worthy of a human and who's not worthy of a human. The Palestinians, for them, are not even human because they don't even, when have they ever imposed sanctions against Israel? When have they ever called for the ICC, the International Criminal Court, to investigate or to hold Netanyahu and his cabinet responsible for all the crimes they've committed, killing Shireen Abu Akla, a very important American Palestinian journalist, not too long ago. We're just marking the one-year anniversary of that. A young lady that was working so hard to cover the atrocities and the attacks by the Israelis, and she was doing her basic job, and she was shot right in the neck. You know what I mean? And then they also attacked her coffin. I mean, this shows you that the Palestinians cannot rely on the United Nations. They cannot rely on these Western governments. They have to rely on their unity and their resistance, and that's it. That's the only way it works. Because if they see that there was hope, they've tried it before. They've seen what Arafat has made agreements before. Mahmoud Abbas has made agreements and bowed down and humiliated himself and his Palestinian people, and they didn't get nothing in return. They got nothing. Well, what did they get? The West Bank is violated every day. They shoot people. They attack houses. They bombard. They blockade. They make their lives miserable. They keep them in insecurity. And what is Mahmoud Abbas? What has he accomplished? Nothing. The only people that have accomplished something are the resistance and the unity of the resistance. Okay. And let's hope that it keeps growing and stronger and stronger.
Let's get a final thought in from Charlotte Cates. Has a lack of action over the years from international bodies such as the UN, the EU, the OIC, most notably from Arab governments, contributed to the status quo?
Well, of course it has. And this is, largely due to the involvement and the direction provided by the United States, Britain, the European powers, Canada, essentially the imperialist forces that have sought to maintain the Zionist project in the region as their kind of military base to disrupt the region and maintain hegemony and control over people's destiny, future, and resources. And it's the Palestinian resistance and their allies in the Lebanese resistance and all the forces of the resistance in the region and around the world that are actually standing up on the front lines to confront that imperialism and create a better future for all of us everywhere in the world.
All right, thanks a lot. Manager of Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najm, joining us from Toronto, and also International Coordinator at Samdoun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, Charlotte Cates, joining us from Vancouver. Thanks for contributing to the program, and also a special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intel Sat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means...
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from...
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decreed. His decree, though, we learn...
Ya ilaha kull shay'in wa malika ya rabba.
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah.
Ya khaliqa kull shay'in wa waritha.
Today's great tip: be careful of the deceptions of shaitan and how this will help us in our ubudiyya, our service, our worship, and our obedience to Allah. So, dear listeners, we are humbly speaking about how we should be very careful of the deceptions of shaitan and, of course, how this will help our ubudiyya, our service, our worship, and our obedience to Allah. Now, dear friends, of course, you know, some things seem to be quite self-explanatory, but it is always excellent to remind ourselves constantly, because it seems like one of the characteristics of human beings is that they very quickly forget and move on. And so you tend to forget the different things that you learn. And so, of course, a reminder is something that is always good, and at times it is necessary. Now, when it comes to the spiritual matters and the matters related to religion and deen, and of course Islam, it is recommended to constantly remember certain things, right? The Holy Quran is full of places where the theme is constantly repeated. Sometimes even the words are repeated. In order for us to be able to constantly have certain themes and certain phrases and certain terms in our minds. And so likewise, there are certain warnings that we must constantly repeat to ourselves so that we are always on guard and aware of our, you know, spiritual surroundings, if you will. Because if we are not careful, then we can fall into the various different traps and pitfalls that shaitan lays for every single one of us. Now, of course, you know, we must be careful of the deceptions that shaitan puts forth. And so one of the things that we should do is to look into the lives of the divine messengers and the divine prophets and the divine imams and learn the different things that they have taught us, which can help us to, you know, avoid these pitfalls and these traps that are laid down by shaitan. Of course, you know, one of the things that we need to constantly remember is the idea that shaitan is our open enemy. He is our manifest enemy, and he is our greatest enemy. And, of course, this is what the Holy Quran says. The Holy Quran, the word of the Almighty Allah, calls Shaitan out as the Aduvum Mubin, the clear, manifest enemy, the open enemy. And of course, this enemy and this enmity is not something that Prophet Adam or the sons of